At this time, we begin the technical man. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. And as usual, you guys have to listen to this boring introduction because there's always new people joining the tech net and they ask the question, what the heck is this? Why should I listen to it? Why is it going to be any benefit to me? The tech net is a gathering of the clan of curious radio amateurs. From my point of view, if you're going to be a scientist, if you're going to really want to know how the world works, world of electronics, the world of physics, whatever, the highest priority is to have curiosity. You don't necessarily need a super high IQ, the world's best laboratory. If you've got curiosity and you pursue that curiosity, you're going to find out something. That curious amateur radio operator, that curious scientist, is saying to himself, hey, Mother Nature is telling me something. I'm not quite sure what the message is, but I'm going to try to figure it out. So, the curious people gather here. That's an opinion on my part. Let me drop. So they gather here, join each other, and help educate each other. The world of radio electronics is reasonably complicated, reasonably poorly handled in our institutions and our colleges, from my point of view. The subject is not taught in a useful engineering information manner, and the hams who meet here and help educate each other, put it into their vocabulary, and manage to get the message apart, message across. How does the transmission line work? How does an antenna work? In fact, later on tonight, we're probably going to re-enter the subject we had last week on the subject of slow wave structures. Why does that light wave travel through a magnifying glass at a slower rate? Why does that radio wave travel down the boom of Yagi at a slower rate? And I was misunderstanding Wesley's question on that subject. N2XJN, Wesley was asking, okay, you keep saying that the director string is a slow wave structure. It acts capacitive and the signal flows through there more slowly. Why? He kept asking that. At the time, I wasn't quite hearing what he was saying. It was sounding to me like the question of somebody saying, why is water wet? That's a hard one to answer. But I did think about it some more, and let's see now. I'm trying to remember the call letters of the guy who, it was Roy, who gave me some further information on this. Another way of looking at it, AC2GS, as to why that signal travels more slowly through glass, why that signal travels some more slowly through the boom area of a Yagi antenna. So we're going to go back to that. We got a little more information on that one. Turns out that Wes was asking a pretty good question that wasn't being answered. I wasn't hearing his question, if you know what I mean. The very loose schedule, let me drop this. The very loose schedule that we follow on the TechNet is during the first hour, we take people who sign in with their name and their call letters, because they do have a question or a comment. You need not have a long list of people signing in because they're listening. The TechNet's been around now for going on 33 years. Started in September of 1982. After 33 years, we believe somebody is listening. The total length of this particular net might be a record holder as to the number of years and the number of hours. Well over 5,000 hours with the TechNet are in the bag. I mean, there's a very enthusiastic volunteer, Mike number one, KC2NJI, Mike Perry, has volunteered more than 10 years ago to record all of the TechNet, and it's on that website of his, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. So you can go back to that website over the last 10 years, choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and listen to past issues of the TechNet if that's what you want to do. So it's quite a resource. A number of college professors have told their students to either listen to the TechNet or to go to that website in order to find out what the real world of radio electronics is like these days. Let me drop this. Another contributing website is the one by Mike number two, which is limartechnet.com. And Mike number two, K1MJN, Mike Juliet Mike, has an awful lot of contributing information. For instance, in either one of those websites, you can get a copy of a Smith chart. And we'll be doing a little bit of discussion of a Smith chart and what it means with reference to slow wave structures. Why does that signal travel more slowly? slowly through that director string of a Yagi. Believe it or not, some of that answer is on that Smith chart, if you know how to look at it. Hard to believe. Okay, as I said, the loose schedule is that during the first hour, we take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment, and they're going to give me their call letters, the name, and the word yes, meaning they do have a question or a comment. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who mans the pro bag. In other words, people who don't yet have the right equipment, the right license, and they talk to us directly. By one means or another, they communicate with John with their question. He also monitors the chat room and Echo Link. So he's got his fingers in a whole lot of places, a whole lot of pies, in which he keeps contact with people who are trying to contact us. So if we override, if we don't wait for the beeps and people get not a chance to sign in by way of Echo Link, John knows about it and brings it to our attention. Let me drop. John collects 1, 2, 3, 4 of the 4 interesting general questions that get communicated to him on the mailbag, and we discuss those. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, is our space expert. He gives us the latest on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration and the Europeans and the Germans and the Japanese, what all the space agencies are doing, what's going on in space. I always ask him that question. What's the latest on Voyager? It's only been out there for 30-some-odd years. It's only 12 billion miles away, three times the distance to Pluto. What's Voyager saying these days? It's the most long-ranging piece of electronics, long-ranging piece of hardware that mankind has ever issued. That's the record holder. And how in the world can a 6-watt QRP transmitter 12 billion miles away continuously talk to us day in and day out? That is a monstrous distance to be sending a QRP signal. And it's proof positive of that philosophy I have. You connect a transmitter to an antenna and you transmit. That signal coming out of that antenna goes to every single cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. It's going to go there. The only thing left for you to discuss is whether or not your equipment is sensitive enough to pick up that weak signal. Use the right technology. What's the weakest signal you can listen to? There is no limit. Ain't that crazy? Let me drop. So lots of people who say, hey, my handy talkie only goes 1 mile, and I'm standing on the ground talking to another person a mile away. So the handy talkie's going to only get a range of 1 mile. You can believe that. Put that handy talkie in the hands of astronaut Owen Garriott on the space shuttle, and that handy-talkie will easily talk 1,500 miles. That little 5-watt handy-talkie did that, and I heard that signal when he was over North Texas here on Long Island. That's another whole story. Okay, at this time, we're going to begin taking check-ins. So if you've got a question or comment for the net, right now you're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. K2RA, they'll be listening.
Name here is Joe, and yes.
One. Yes.
KC2RAXP, John, yes.
Delta 2, Canada Golf Lima, Robert, yes.
W2RAY, Joe, yes.
Okay, I heard Rich and 2EO, a whole bunch of doubles, triples, and quadruples, followed by John, KC2IXP, followed by Robert, number 2, something 2, KGL, followed by Joe, W2RYY. Okay, that very first Joe, who I didn't get his call letters, give me your call letters, Joe.
This is KC2, Queen, Yankee, Whiskey.
Okay, we got Joe, Queen Yankee Whiskey. So we got Rich, Joe, John, Robert, and another Joe, W2RYY. Who did I miss? Give me your call letters and name right now, K2RAW.
I delaw to connect off.
An error has occurred.
Hang on a minute.
Roger.
WK2J, the handle is J.
Auto Connect enabled.
QSQS, Chris, with a comment.
This is N1YDY, Hank, yes.
So Delta 2, Canada Golf Lima, Robert, yes.
This is AC2IS, Bill, yes.
KC2LXD, Rodney, with a question. West 2N4 with the space report.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club.
Eric, do you want me to wait a little longer?
126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, this time we've only had 10 or 12 people signing in. It's a real light night. John, KC2 WGB.
Dog's out.
I got Rich, Joe, John, Robert, Joe, another John, Bill, Chris, Hank, Rodney. Is that all? Okay, we're going to go over to the first person with a comment. Keep it a little bit brief, Rich. N2EO. We got a long list tonight. K2LAW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. I'll try and keep it brief. I got a very disturbing phone call a couple of hours ago from Hal. Hal understands that troubles him from a lot of this week. Helps him find any good to it. I'm curious, open that way. Anybody has any comment with them to me? At yahoo.com. Back in it.
Understand, Rich. And that was a decision by the board of directors. So, to some degree, we have no choice but to follow the board of directors' decision. And those who feel differently, apparently Rich is collecting information from those who have an opinion on the subject. Okay, the next person signing in was Joe, KC2, I can't read my own writing here, JW, I think it is, Quebec Juliet Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe, and correct me if I got your call letters wrong. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, hi. It's Queen Yankee Whiskey.
Queen Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe.
Yeah, roger that. Hey, how you guys doing? My question is to you is, next year in February the 22nd, I think, the year 2017, right? My question to you is, I have to renew my amateur radio license, so do I have to take the test all over again, or I just have to pay a fee, and what website do I go on to renew my general license? Back to you, Dick.
Assuming that your license has not expired, and even if it did, you get a grace period of at least a year or two. So you're continuously operating amateur radio for the last 5 or 10 years. Renewing your license is only, to my knowledge, filling out a form, an FCC form. And that can be done...
Form 610.
Form 610. You can do that with paper. And I think there's a way of doing that through the Internet. Correct me on that one, Eric. And I think there is no fee to renew your license for the next 10 years. You're a little closer to the FCC than I am, Eric, because as a broadcast engineer, you have to worry about maintaining all of their rules day in and day out. So I'm sure you've gone through the license renewal process. Give us a few words on that. KE2EJ, our famous broadcast engineer, local K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, I'm not really the right person to ask, but I don't remember what the FCC website is. Not the regular website. You can find it by going to the FCC website. The only thing is you have to know what your FRIN number is if you're going to do it via the Internet. Otherwise, you're going to fill out the piece of paper. somebody who's a little more up on it will probably give you a better answer than I just did. Get your IWP, it's your
Universal Licensing System. Look up that on Google and it'll bring it to the FCC website that'll enable you to license to renew online.
Do you keep 2-2 with information?
Okay. That was Joe number one. KG2T is Joe number two. Go Joe number two. Sounds like you've done it. And by the way, what is this FRN number? And if you don't have it, how do you get one? KG2T, K2RIW, the tech man.
Quick question.
Okay, good evening everybody, this is KG2T. Dick, I just recently renewed my license. If the gentleman is a member of ARRL, the ARRL will send him a notification about 60 days or so before it's due to renew, and they'll send him the forms, and all he has to do is fill out the forms, and it will be done automatically in that fashion. If he is a member of the ARRL, if he is not, like it's been said, go to the FCC website, get the forms, fill them out, send them in. This is KG2T, back to that.
Look up your FRN number if you don't know it. Maybe to IQNS.
Come in.
By the way, FRN stands for Federal Registration Number.
Okay, KB2IQN, mobile. Chris, how does one establish an FRN number, if that's what you're telling us about?
You can look it up on QRZ.
And Dick, WS2N, it's on the front of your license.
Oh-ho. Let's see if Chris has got any further words on that. KB2IQN, mobile, K2RIW.
Comment.
Now, maybe Chris is out of the area right now. I think it was Bill, AC2IS, who had said, first he said had a question. If that was you, Bill, go right ahead.
Dick, this is AC2IS here. Had some information. We did the test with both Plastidip and hot glue in a microwave oven for 2 minutes, along with a cup of water. In that time, the cup of water got to the point where it was steaming. We had the Plastidip and the hot glue in separate paper bowls. And the paper bowl seemed warmer than either the hot glue or the Plastidip. They did not seem to they didn't seem to absorb too much energy. A little warmth there, not much. Also, though, we did a test, or rather, Jesse did a test building a cloverleaf antenna. He managed to get an SWR ratio of 1.0, and let me let it drop for a second and pick it up again. So after Jesse got his 1.0 SWR reading without hot glue, he added hot glue to give it the antenna the structural integrity it needs, and the SWR measurement got dramatically worse. So it seems as though hot glue is not absorbing energy, but it is still messing with the SWR of the antenna. So then the question becomes, is there a way to sort of predict what the SWR measurement of the antenna should be, or adding Plastidip and hot glue in order to bring it back to as close as possible to one perfect 1.0 SWR. This is IS.
The last part of your general question is there a way of correcting for the blob of capacitance created by the hot glue? Answer is absolutely yes. Just like any antenna that has any VISWR in the world, you can ask the question, is that VISWR correctable at the antenna or even further downrange in the transmission line? The answer always, if you know what you're doing, is answer is yes. Any standing wave ratio of any antenna is extremely correctable if you're smart enough. So when we get to that discussion later on capacitive effects and slow wave structures, we're going to get deeper into that one. My mind's going blank. Bill, never heard of you. Bill, you a little bit later. Hang in there. And the next person on the list, Latina, did we answer that last question of Joe's? Let's see. Let me go back to Joe to make sure. Mr. QYW, did we answer your question? KQYW, the tech man. Go ahead, Joe. Yeah, he was asking about renewing the license, and I think we've pretty much covered that one. The next person signing in was John, KC2IXP. Go right ahead, John, KQYW, the tech man.
On, my question is regarding to the antenna. How important is transit trap in that line?
Yeah, once again, our message is going to be, if you're hearing things on the technical net that you think should not be there, please go to the reverse mode. In other words, listen to the 146.25 megahertz input frequency, write down the time and the signal strength that you experienced, and please report it as soon as you can to Limark.org. Signing is Limark.org, but Limark.com. Anyhow, you're going to go to the Limark test website, and there's a place.
.org.
Okay, .org. So it's Limark.org. L-I-M-A-R-C. Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club is what that stands for. IMARC.org, and you're going to report what you hear, signal strength, and the time that you heard it. Very valuable information so that we can help the FCC pin down the person or persons who are being disruptive. So please do that for us. John, try one more time. KC2IXP. Try to give us your question one more time. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, it's Kilo Delta 2 in the X-ray, Papa. My question is, how important is the transit trap or surge protector in the line from the antenna to your radio in the transmission or reception cable?
Yeah, that's a pretty good question, John. And you're going to get very different opinions on various people when you ask that question. I'm sitting on a piece of land 300 feet above sea level, very carefully selected by me, because I knew I'm going to be dwelling with ham radio for the rest of my life, and I wanted a good location. So, in theory, I should be hit with lightning all the time. And I got a 100-foot tower that my antenna sits on. I should be hit with lightning all the time. I have never used any surge protector on any of my antennas. Maybe I'm very foolish. Maybe I've gotten away with it for the last 40 years that I've lived here. So, particularly if your antenna is well designed so that within the antenna there is a DC short, an RF choke, so to speak, do you really need one of those surge protectors if you've got well-installed coax cables? From my experience, the answer would seem to be not necessarily a mandatory requirement. But if you're a belt and suspenders person, it's a very valuable thing to have in the antenna. And on that exact subject, if you take a look at the March issue of QST Magazine, and if you go to page 58, you'll see a submittal by K2RIW to the doctors in Joel Hallis, W1ZR, has this monthly column called The Doctor Is In. And on that very subject of a surge protector put into a coax cable, K2LAW has a submittal. There, the application is to put the surge protector between your exciter and the final amplifier. If you're a person who periodically mistunes your final amplifier, so that the final tube arcs over, and you get a 3,000 volt power supply with a backed up with a real capacitor, or a stealthy capacitor, that can put one hell of a surge on the coax cable going back to your exciter and damage the final transistors in the exciter.
Repeater, timeout.
The same thing.
So that airport putting a surge protector in the line going from your exciter to your final amplifier. It can give you a lot of protection, and that's what my my submittal to the doctor is in the March issue, is talking about. So surge protectors can give you a lot of protection, and everybody thinks a surge protector is only intended for an antenna transmission line. Not necessarily. Just putting it in the line going from your exciter to your final amplifier can give you a lot of benefit. So surge protectors, from my point of view, are good belt and suspenders. A well-designed, well-installed surge protector gives you no disadvantage, no insertion loss. It's not an expensive item, so it could give you a lot of protection. The thing you worry about quite often is a lightning surge occurring in your neighborhood could damage the front end of your receiver, and that surge protector would protect you in that case. So do you need it? And the answer is yes and no, depending on how safe you want to be, how much you're willing to invest, and so on. I've gotten away without them, but maybe you're a smarter person that wants to use one, John. 82IXP, K2LIW in the tech net. West, you have a brief question on that exact subject of the surge protector. N2XJN, K2LAW, go ahead, West. Okay, so that interference is very close to you and you're getting a strong signal. It's also showing up on my map, if you know what that means. So this person is not very well hidden, so to speak. Okay, the next person on our list was Robert. Blank, blank, number 2, Kilowatt, Gulf, Lima. Give me that prefix, Robert, and then proceed. Mr. 2, KGL, K2RIW. I'm going to hang in here. Go ahead, Robert.
Both cells.
Mr. Kilowatt Golf Lima, Robert, go right ahead.
I monitor the 902 repeater in Westside with Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club, and it seems that they are just out of range. It's about 20 miles from Oceanside. When a jet comes in from the east...
Go on to the other input.
What I think I heard for your question, Robert, was the 900 meg repeater that's over the horizon from you, which is weak in your QTH. When a jet airplane flies over, I am guessing you hear peaks and valleys of signal, you hear flutter, and you're hearing aircraft reflection. When I was talking to K4CAW, 480 miles away in Greensboro, North Carolina, on 432, it took us a while to figure out why the signal got so extremely strong for 2 minutes at a time, periodically. We soon realized that an aircraft flying over Washington, D.C., which is the midpoint of that 480-mile path between Long Island and Greensboro, North Carolina, 200 miles inland, that aircraft at the midpoint at 30 or 40,000 feet is a huge reflecting object, reflecting that signal forward. So aircraft flying over, back in the days when we used to have non-keyed AGC, simple derived AGC on television sets. Many of us in the old days with a television set with your RCA 630 television, let me drop, would watch the picture flutter in and out as an aircraft flew over while you're watching channel 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, 11. So back in the old days, with simple automatic gain control of a television set, you would watch the picture flutter in and out as an aircraft flew over. Later designs of television sets had a more classy automatic gain control circuit that was gated into only the peak signal from the sync pulse of the television set, and a lot of that effect went away. So it's been there forever. An aircraft flying over, particularly at the midpoint between you and the signal you want to listen to. It's going to give you some nice, strong reflections. They're going to make the signal come and go. And so, what little I understand from your question, Robert, I think that some of the information you might be looking for. Blank, blank, number 2, kilowatt, Golf Lima, K2RIW. Go ahead, Robert.
Hey, that's part of it. Part of the question is the tonal change. It seems as the plane goes towards JFK and it's slowing down, it starts at a high tone, I guess it's a flutter, I don't know. It seems like there's a tonal change from a high tone down to a zero, and then it goes up a little bit and then just disappears. Why the tonal change?
Boy, have I got an answer for you. Give me your prefix, Robert, on your call letters.
Delta 2.
Okay, something Delta 2. Squeeze the mic, wait a second, and then tell us. Is it W? Is it Kilo Delta 2? Go ahead, Robert.
Kilo Delta 2.
Very fine, Robert. Kilo Delta 2 with Kilo Golf Lima. Don, good question. You're a curious guy, and you've recognized an interesting characteristic of radio propagation. As an airplane flies closer to the airport, as it flies closer to you, as it flies closer to the signal, at various times you will hear the tone of intermod. That's not intermod. It's a heterodyne. The heterodyning tone, you'll hear it go up and down in pitch. And boy, did I experience that on many occasions with this 480-mile pass between me and Greensboro, North Carolina, during the 4 years I was running that experiment. 432 single sideband, and I'm hearing these tones going up and down. And those tones was an extremely strong clue that led us to finally figure out what was happening. Where was the aircraft, and why were we hearing that tone? That heterodyne tone, you're going to definitely hear it on a single sideband signal. You're going to definitely hear it on an amplitude modulated signal. To some degree, you will hear that on an FM signal, because you still have, in the case of a weak carrier, you still have a weak carrier that is going in phase, out of phase, with the two separate paths. Let me drop. As you can tell, the length of the path from the transmitter to you, the direct path, is one signal path length. The other signal path length goes from the transmitter up to the aircraft, reflects off the aircraft, and comes to you. That's the one that's a changing path. That's the one that's creating the heterodyne. In other words, because of a Doppler shift-like phenomenon, those two signals are arrived at your receiver slightly different in frequency. They beat against each other, and you hear that tone. It's harder to hear that tone on FM, but it's there. It's a lot easier to hear it in AM or sideband on an amplitude primarily detecting system. Now, where's the tone coming from? The technique I came up with, from my point of view, in order to visualize it, let me drop. Make believe that the main path going from the transmitter to you is something you know about. The path going up to the aircraft and down to you is the equivalent of a bowstring. Make believe that there is a string going from the transmitter up to the aircraft, and down to your receiver. That string is changing in length depending on how you pluck the string. As the aircraft gets closer to either end, either the transmitting end or the receiving end, that string is changing in overall length. The plucking of that string is changing in length a hell of a lot faster than when the aircraft is in the middle. When the aircraft is in the middle between transmitter and receiver, and the aircraft is flying directly parallel to the path, there is no tone. It goes through a zero beat. If the aircraft is flying at a right angle to the path, then the signal starts off at a very high pitch, goes through zero beat as the aircraft goes to the midpoint, and then starts going up to a high pitch again as the aircraft goes out the other side. You're plucking a string, and the change in length of the string in wavelengths is what's causing the tone. if the string is being plucked in such a way that the length of the string up to the aircraft and down to you from the transmitter is changing at a particular rate, which is 100 wavelengths per second is the rate you're changing that length of string, you're going to hear a beat tone, a heterodyne, of 100 hertz. So it's the rate of change of the path length and the difference between the two. Those two signals are heterodyning, beating against each other, and as they beat against each other, sometimes they're co-phase and you get a stronger signal. Sometimes they're anti-phase, out of polarity with each other, and you get a value of signal.
Repeater, timeout.
So therefore, your receiver is listening to the rate of change of the mixing of those two signals, or the amplitude difference that goes on because of the heterodyning. And the heterodyning is a kind of a Doppler shift. It's really the rate of change in wavelengths per second of the plucking of that string. I know that's not so easy to visualize the first time. If you draw a horizontal diagram of transmitter, receiver, direct path, and then you draw another line up to the aircraft, reflecting off of it, and then down to your receiver, and now you let that aircraft fly in various directions, closer and further from either end, at right angles to the path, parallel to the path, and you calculate the geometry of the change of the length of that string up to the aircraft that's being plucked, so to speak. The rate of change of that string length is what gives you that heterodyne. I wonder if that picture helps a little bit, Robert, sorry about that. KT2, Kilowatt Golf Lima, K2RIW. You got it, Robert.
Yes, I was thinking in terms of Doppler shift and also reflection. Also, as the plane slows as it comes into JFK, you also notice a slowing of the flutter, too. So there's another phenomenon that you can add in. It seems to me that 902, and I don't notice this with 440 or 2 meters, really prefers a straight line more so than the lower frequencies. It would rather go up to the plane and come down than negotiate all those trees and branches between West Islip and Oceanside. Thank you for the answer. I really appreciate it. Back to Ned.
Yeah, very fine, Robert. Good question. Good curiosity as to why those tones change like that. Joe Taylor, our Nobel laureate ham radio operator, was now being mentioned a lot because of gravity wave detection, and he got a Nobel Prize because of his indirect, very first gravity wave detection way back in 1972 and in 1980s when he was listening to this binary star pulsar and carefully measuring signals, the rate of change of signal versus time. He was also looking at tones. Well, he's had some articles I've seen where he is using his audio spectrum analyzer display on his computer in order to display the 2 meter signals that have this Doppler shift heterodyning tone. But when you display it as an audio spectrum analyzer versus time, a waterfall display, you get some very interesting diagrams showing you the amplitude and the frequency shift of those tones when an aircraft flies near his property. He does that on 2 meters. Let me drop. As you go up to higher frequencies, in general, the phenomena becomes stronger for two reasons. One, we tend to use more directive antennas, which really means the signal getting to the aircraft, in some cases, is stronger. Two, at higher frequencies, the wavelength is shorter. Therefore, the exact same number of meters per second of path length change, the plucking of the string, because the wavelengths are smaller at a higher frequency, the exact same aircraft speed will give you a higher tone at a higher frequency. When you listen to those tones at the 10 gigahertz ham band, boy, you hear some very interesting tones when you're listening to a long path signal over the horizon and there's aircraft flying between you and him, and you listen to those tones. Boy, you get some nice high pitch tones because at 10 gigahertz, the wavelength is 1 inch. You get a peak or in a valley of signal every time the aircraft moves 1 inch and change in the plucking of that string, the path length. So I've often thought to myself that love to be able to hear. Let me drop this. The day will come when we will have the equivalent of a single sideband receiver for light frequencies. I mean, every decade they go up another 10 to 1 in frequency of the frontier ham radio frequencies being used. The day will come when you're going to be able to hear the Doppler shift tone out of a receiver when you've got two different paths being reflected with a light wave. Boy, you're going to hear a high pitch. You just move your finger a little bit and you're going to hear a high squealing tone, in my opinion. It'll be a very interesting sounding science signal when that day comes, when we can hear the heterodyne of audio. You could say that the LIGO, the laser interferometry gravity wave detector, is sending a signal of, I think it's a 1500 nanometers, or is it 1024 nanometers? 1024 nanometers is the signal coming out of this 20-watt laser, which is bouncing back and forth 400 times on each one of those 4-kilometer-long tunnels. And as a gravity wave comes along, let me drop. Those two signals, the one bouncing back and forth, the direct and the indirect signal, so to speak, create a tone. And as that gravity wave comes along and changes the east-west path versus the north-south path, those two laser signals at 1024 nanometers beat against each other. That's what created the chirp in the LIGO detector that we've been hearing about for the last couple of weeks. So heterodyning is a very important phenomenon when there's more than one signal path. It's giving you a lot of information. If you're curious enough to ask, why is that tone there? Why is it changing in pitch? Why is it changing in amplitude? How does it do it as the reflecting object, like an aircraft, in your case, is in various locations, moving in various directions, at various velocities? Interesting phenomenon. Okay, the next guy on our list was the other Joe, W-E-2-R-Y-Y. And haven't heard from you in a long time, Joe. I'm having some fun with Joe. And so, how are those electrons treating you on the south shore of Long Island? W-E-2-R-Y-Y. K2RIW and TechNet. You've got it, Joe.
Good evening, Big. I ask you funny questions like you said before, but in reverse order. Why is it water dry?
Boy, if your young son asks you that question, why is water wet? Why isn't water dry? Why does water act like that? Simple sounding questions, depending how deep you get into it at the atomic level. Darn complicated. Mother Nature is giving you a lot of messages that you got to try to figure out what the hell the real message is. So, water is a magic material. My goodness. Why in the world does it have maximum density at 4 degrees centigrade? You go colder or hotter, water will expand. Why in the world does a dielectric constant go from 81 when it's liquid to number 3 when it's ice as a solid? Why in the world does this Lost tangent go from an extremely high number when it's a liquid to a very low number when it's ice? Why does water do all that? Why is it wet? I don't think I've got even the beginning of answers for any of those, Joe. The B2RYY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
That was just a to be funny question. That wasn't my real question. You want my real question? I'll give my real question.
We're all ears, Joe.
And to be sure, why? A couple of techniques ago, I asked a question on change the apparent length of a dipole will change the impedance. Apparently, shortening the dipole from its, say, at like a nominal length at a particular frequency would give you a nominal impedance of, say, 72 ohms if everything, you know, was in a semi-perfect world. And theoretically, if you shorten the antenna, the impedance goes up. Everything goes down to a lower number. Now, the difference between, say, 72 ohms to 50 ohms is a change of about 69.4%, but the length of the antenna to be decreased would not be done the same. That'd be like a drastic change. Is there any way to calculate this, or is it can it be expressed in an equation that's predictable? Like, if you want to change the impedance of the antenna from, say, 72 ohms to something lower to match your transmission line of 50 ohms,
of the impedance of a dipole versus length. Absolutely. Do not use it. It's put in the books as the be-all, end-all equation, and you think it's got great answers. And you read all the caveats with that question. It only works when you're very close to the resonant frequency. And away from the resonant frequency, the formula fails miserably. You want to know the impedance of a dipole versus length. There's a couple of ham radio philosopher guys, real smart guys. I think they were at Bell Labs, 1946-45. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, who measured the real impedance. The hell with this equation that tries to calculate what's going on. They measured the real impedance. You go to those two curves, the Brown and Woodward curves, which you can get on either mic number one or mic number two's website. Those Brown and Woodward curves are there. And that those, by curves, I mean you have two separate graphs. One graph tells you the resistive component versus length for various diameters of monopole, and the other graph tells you reactive component versus length for various diameters of monopole. Let me drop. And a monopole is exactly half of a dipole, or a dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back. So every impedance you read off that graph, either of those two graphs, you double it in order to use for your dipole. That's the real measured impedance done with a real slotted line and a slide rule way back in 1946. Every single issue of every respected antenna book, all of the issues of the JASIC Antenna Engineering Handbook, and also those two mic number one and mic number two websites will show you those curves. That is the answer. Now you study those curves. You choose the diameter. You choose the particular curve that's on the graph for resistance or the graph for reactance. You choose the particular curve that represents your length to diameter ratio, A to D ratio, they call it. And now as you change the length of your dipole, that's the horizontal axis, you can read off the graph the exact impedance of the reactive component, whether or not it's capacitive or inductive, and how many ohms of the resistive component. So therefore, you have in your hands the way of getting the exact impedance, and that exact impedance, when you write it out, is an equation where Z, the impedance is Z equals R plus JX. Impedance is equal to, first of all, there's the R, the resistive component, plus JX. J means it's the reactive component. J is the square root of minus one, so-called I. And X is the reactance number, plus or minus some number of ohms you read off the graph. So you can therefore, in the series equivalent circuit of a dipole, a resistor in series with a reactor, that's the real impedance of a dipole, the easiest representation. You now know the exact impedance. That's a so-called complex number. Now there's a whole branch of mathematics of how you handle a complex number. Let me drop. Reading it off the graph, that's the easy part. Figuring out how to use that complex number, their life gets a little bit more complicated. I guarantee there's a website somewhere where you can plug in a complex number, and now you can add, subtract, multiply, and do whatever you want with it. With the right kind of a calculator, you can do it on your own handheld calculator. By way of a computer program you can go to on the right website, I guarantee you can do that. Now let me tell you the next step. You want to know what's the VISWR going to be? Let me drop. There's a well-respected formula among antenna engineers where you want to know the magnitude of the standing wave ratio. You do that by taking Z is the impedance of your antenna. It's that R plus JX. Zero is a whatever your characteristic impedance you care about. Usually it's 50 ohms. If you're using a 50 ohm cable, C0 is 50. So therefore the formula is Z minus Z0 divided by Z plus Z0. That is the reflection coefficient. That tells you what voltage you're going to get reflected back from your antenna, tells you exactly what phase angle that voltage is going to be in complex mathematics. That's the hard part. It takes a whole lot of getting used to complex mathematics. It's usually given as a course for a college electronic engineer. I think that's given in the freshman or the sophomore class level, handling those complex numbers. A little bit nasty at the first time you do it, but going to the right website, you'll be able to do it. once you know the exact magnitude of the reflection signal by way of that formula, you know how strong and what phase angle is the reflected signal. Let me drop. That allows you to put a dot on the Smith chart. And that's one way of doing it. Let me think now. Once you know the resistive and reactive component, yes. As long as you know by way of this Brown and Woodward curves, the resistive component and the reactive component for your length of dipole or monopole, that resistive component and reactive component is a dot on one location on your Smith chart. And then by way of that dot being some number of centimeters away from the center of the Smith chart, tells you exactly what the standing wave ratio is going to be. The outer perimeter of the Smith chart tells you exactly what phase angle the signal is going to be and how strong is the signal going to be when it reflects back to you. So it's a little bit complicated to get used to these formulas and dealing with reactive numbers. But let me drop. Let me go one step closer to what I think you're really asking. Joe, you and I wish that all I had to do is change the length of my dipole, and now I would make the resistive component go from 10 ohms to 50 ohms to 100 ohms to 300 ohms. We wish it was that simple. Unfortunately, Mother Nature made this one a hell of a lot more complicated. If you start off with exactly a half wavelength electronically, 0.95% velocity factor, if electronically your dipole is exactly a half wavelength long, it will, in free space with reasonable diameter wire, give you a 73 ohm impedance. Resistive component, 73 ohms. Reactive component, 0. Now you start changing the length of the dipole, and the impedance goes up real fast. You would like to think the impedance is the resistive component up and down. Almost absolutely not. When you look at those two graphs, the resistive graph and the reactive graph, you realize the reactive graph has got an extremely steep slope to it. The resistive graph has got a very low slope. So in other words, as you change the length of your dipole, you get a huge amount of reactance happening real fast. The reactive component dominates, usually 10 times faster. So when you change the length of the dipole, yeah, you're adjusting the resistive component a little bit. The reactive component goes sky high real fast. Make it short, it's capacitive. Make it long, it's inductive, real fast. If you're willing to use a reactive corrector, in other words, if your dipole is now shorter and it's capacitive, let me drop it. And you add the right value of inductor, either in series with your dipole or in shunt with your dipole, two slightly different answers, you can correct the reactive component and only the resistive component is left. So, does your antenna go up in impedance when you change the length from resonance? Yay, verily, real fast. And you'd like to believe it's the resistive component changing. Unfortunately, the answer is no. It's the reactive component changing real fast. It dominates. There's good news and bad news there. The bad news is it's hard to figure out what's going on. The good news is that you have the ability to correct the reactive component, in which case you're just by adding that shunt inductor, in some cases a shunt capacitor, so that, or in series, so therefore you're only left with the resistor component. And yes, now when you're left with only the resistor component, by adjusting nothing but the length of the dipole, after you've resonated it, re-resonated it, by adding the right corrective reactor, you can make the resistive component of your dipole anywhere from 1 ohm to 1500 ohms by just changing the length of the dipole. You have the ability to make the impedance of your dipole anything you want. But in order for that resistive component, anything you want, to be useful, you got to first correct the reactive component that's almost always there. The reactive component happens first. You got to correct it. Let me drop. Because any transmission line looking at a dipole an antenna impedance that has a reactive component is going to be unhappy. Your transmission line is going to be unhappy if the antenna has any significant amount of reactive impedance. Reactive impedance, the good news is it wastes no energy. It stores energy and gives it back to you, usually a standing wave ratio. That's the good news. It wastes no energy. The bad news is it drives your transmission line crazy. And if you don't correct for it, you're going to have a high-vis wire antenna, and it's extremely difficult to make your transmitter put any power into that antenna if there's a reactive component. I hope this helps. I know that each person hearing this jazz the first time says, what in the world's going on? You've got to times before it starts making a little more sense. You'll be asking these questions over and over again, Joe, and that's perfectly acceptable. It'll eventually make a little more sense as you hear it from various angles and various ways of explaining it. W2RYY with a darn good question. KQRIW ProtectNet. By the way, dipoles are extremely poorly misunderstood by an awful lot of people, Joe. You're in good company.
Okay, let me ask the question a little differently. Probably more of an answer of what would you do, DEKQRIW. You work for Company X, and they ask you to make an antenna to go between 902 to 928. You have to design the antenna to work in the mid band, try to get the bandwidth to be as wide as possible to get the lowest return loss of that antenna, okay? I'm not sure what the impedance of this device required the antenna to be. Maybe you had to match it and so forth. But in your calculations or computations or your measurements of what you started with, is there any way of knowing or do you ever remember what you did if you had to shorten the length of something so much by so much percentage of what like an ideal model antenna you start with like what it looks like a modeling program, like it should be this much in length in centimeters or millimeters, and you had to change it by so much of a percentage to get it to be what you want it to be. That's sort of what I guess I'm driving at.
Wow. Did you ask a question? For 10 solid years, as a consultant for a particular company in Long Island, I did exactly that phenomena day in and day out. Because RFID, the main RFID frequency band, is 902 to 928. And the FCC rules say you will use every megacycle of that 902 to 928 in a frequency hopping manner in order to be spread spectrum. The RFID reader must use every frequency between 902 and 928. Across that 26 meg band, if you want your RFID reader to work well, you're going to be tuning for the best possible gain, the lowest possible visual. So you want an antenna, you literally want an antenna, to have no more than a 1.1 standing wave ratio, something like 25 dB reflection coefficient, from 902 to 928 inclusive. That's a stiff requirement. You hand that requirement to any antenna manufacturer on planet Earth, and they will no-bid the job and say you're absolutely crazy to even ask for that. I did that day in and day out, and from my point of view, successfully. A whole bunch of patents came out of it. Let me drop.
And when some of these other people looked at your ideas and saw what you were doing, did you simply tell them, get out of my way because I'm doing it even though you think it can't be done?
Yeah, they had gone out for bids on an antenna like that, and they got nothing but no bids. And I was doing it. I was doing it by a very non-conventional manner. Did I do it by a matching impedance formula? Absolutely not. Did I do it by calculation? Absolutely not. I did it by pure ham radio tinkering. I had no faith for that particular environment. I had no faith in any of the antenna impedance modeling programs. Zero faith. I can tell you a whole lot of stories about that. I did it by pure tinkering with an extremely well-tuned Rode & Schwarz vector network analyzer with a double display. It was a XY display. Horizontal axis was frequency, 902 to 928. Vertical axis was dBs of either gain or dBs of reflection coefficient. And there were two graphs, two plots. One plot was a blue line showing me the gain. The other plot was a yellow line showing me the visual. What I discovered is that if you're doing tinkering, by tinkering I mean I've got a long wooden stick with a piece of copper tape on the end of it.